You're listening to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. It may not be much of a surprise that there are more monuments to Abraham Lincoln and George Washington in the United States than for anyone else. But with last year's racial reckoning and more sensitivity to people being honored, monuments are not just relics of the past. The Monument Lab recently completed an audit to assess the current monument landscape in the U.S. The findings are part of the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation's Monument Project, which intends to transform the way our country's histories are told in public spaces and ensure that future generations inherit a commemorative landscape that venerates and reflects the vast, rich complexity of the American story. Joining us today is Dr. Paul Farber. He's co-founder of the Monument Lab and co-director of the audit, and Naimi Murphy Cicito, Director of Partnerships for the Monument Lab. Thank you for being with us today. Dr. Farber, let me start with you. What is the Monument Lab?
Well, thank you so much for having us on today. Monument Lab is a nonprofit art and history studio. We're based in Philadelphia. We work with artists, educators, municipal agencies on the past, present, and future of monuments. And we began as a classroom project almost a decade ago and have since produced citywide exhibitions, participatory research projects, and really believe that art and history live vitally around us. And we want to understand how we think about monuments as a not just an endpoint of history, but as a bridge toward what comes next.
So how did this audit come about?
Well, you know, we are really grateful for support from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. And as they were in the midst of, you know, really importantly, kind of diving into this question of how do we think about a fuller monument landscape, they wanted to know. I mean, deep down, we are researchers. They are really thoughtful thinkers and wanted to know the baseline. And just to be clear, you know, when it comes to understanding the overarching themes and patterns of the monuments we've inherited, you know, there's a common misperception that there is some central government agency out there that tracks all of our monuments, that has, you know, a big list of all the monuments and when they were built and who they were dedicated to and what they all mean. And that is not the case. In fact, most of our monuments, while they are you know, something we talk about, they're central to our consciousness, sometimes to our cities and towns, they're elusive in understanding how we've gotten them, because there is no one single definition of a monument. That is something that plays out across every corner of this country as we figure out, and we have over generations, how we venerate. And of course, monuments, for the purposes of the audit, was really a way to think about the things that we conventionally call monuments. And so what we ended up doing was pulling on existing data sources from federal, state, local, tribal entities, and out of those data sources that are largely tracking things that are not monuments. Those are historic properties, cemeteries, things that that authorities have been looking at. And out of that, we were able to create a study set of nearly 50,000 conventional monuments that we were able to pull together both through algorithms and also manual research. And by looking at the 50,000 conventional monuments, the study set, that's where we can see overarching patterns and themes that, you know, it's hard to see when you're normally encountering a monument, which is as a one-off symbol. And instead, we wanted to see the ways that monuments over time and over space have made meaning in this country. Mm.
So you talked about 50,000, but you also created a top 50 of the people in which monuments, there are monuments too. In terms of representation, race, sex, occupation, what did you find?
Yeah, so I mean, just to say one off that a lot of the conversation that we have and questions that many of us have about monuments today are contemporary questions. And those who have kept records on monuments over time have not always, and actually seldom, really looked at that. So of the 42 data sources that include the Smithsonian's and other kind of venerated data sources, only six of them even track race or gender as a category. And when they've done that, they've actually done it very unevenly. So if you want to understand the demographics of who has been represented in our monument landscape, we actually have to go through other means. And so what we ended up doing was streamlining different data sources to be able to really look at biographical sources. And you know, what we found, of course, you know, for some people, it may end up being an affirmation of what you already understand, but I do think there are patterns that jump out. I mean, one thing to note is that there are, of this list of top 50, that we have, you know, 44 of the spots to people we would refer to as white men today. And that also includes about 76% who were landowners and 40% that were born into wealth. Half of the top 50 figures enslaved other people. And when we just take a moment to think about that, again, this is not just a one-off symbol here or there. This is a story that has been shaped over generations. We know that this is not what history equals. Monuments tell you a slice of the story of a community, let alone a country. But when it comes to who has been elevated, whose monuments have been maintained, added to and repetition, we're talking about that. You know, think about that as repetition. The story has actually really left out a lot of the ways that we understand ourselves and our communities. And I think it's just important to think about that. And of course, you know, what we're thinking about here is not just the addition or subtraction of a monument. It's really about how do we better support a shift in representation that acknowledges complexity and multiplicity so that history is not single voiced.
Five of the top 50 figures are Black or Indigenous. And, you know, this is just kind of a something that you mention in your review of this is that there are more monuments depicting mermaids than depicting U.S. congresswomen, and by a lot, right?
Yeah, by magnitude of 11 times. And, you know, just to note with that, I mean, I think it's important to again, note that this is a study set. This is not a tally of every single thing that we may call a monument in this country, but it does give you a sense from nearly 50,000 examples from every state and territory, what you get a sense of. And I will say, you know, it is much harder to find statues of historic women in public spaces. And, you know, I have to say, you know, over just anecdotally, I have in my life seen a couple of statues to US congresswomen in the last few weeks in Pennsylvania and New Jersey and Michigan. I've seen likenesses of mermaids in public spaces, let alone street names, let alone other kind of iconography. But one thing I also do want to point out here is, you know, we have actually in the course of a number of our dialogues that people are drawn to this study, this finding, this anecdote, but, you know, we've gotten more questions about mermaids than systemic racism, about settler colonialism. Oh, I think it's just interesting how we kind of loop back to, in some cases, the allegorical or mythic symbols. And it does give us an insight in what we often put a spotlight on and what we don't in our culture.
Naima Murphy Salcido, you're the Director of Partnerships for the Monument Lab. And a lot of what you do, from what I understand, deals with the current situation. I mean, you deal with activists. You deal. Well, tell us just exactly what you do.
Sure. My role at Monument Lab, you know, as Paul described, we work with so many different types of folks in this work, and a big part of my job is, you know, connecting with artists, students, activists, municipal agencies, you know, and cultural institutions that really want to think about participatory approaches to how we consider collective memory and how we engage the public on those subjects.
Well, so that brings us to today. I mean, a lot of monuments obviously are to figures from the past, but I don't know, just an observation, if we could go back to the mass shooting at a church in Charleston, South Carolina, that seemed to generate a lot of conversation, a lot of interest in this topic as to, you know, Confederate flag, for example, and who there were monuments to. Charlottesville, a few years ago, you know, that started over the removal of a statue of Robert E. Lee. So this seems to be, it would seem that you are very busy in your job today. What are you hearing from across the country?
I think in the work that we do, that we've, in the exhibitions we've done and the partnerships we've kind of continued to pursue, a big piece of our work is about, you know, trying to tell more accurate stories, right? So, you know, as described in the audit, the movement to misrepresent the country's history has been nuanced and well-resourced. So the work required to tell more accurate and representative histories must also have varied types of support and outlets. And so our work, our current projects, you know, whether we're, you know, we've been working with the state of New Jersey, for example, just completed an exploratory artistic research residency that brought together 9 New Jersey-based practitioners to really reflect on the multiple genealogies of the American Revolution. And I think that that project and others that we have coming up that we've done in the past are really about folks staking claim in how we tell histories to make sure that they're not missing so many folks moving forward.
Well, let's use George Washington as an example. Maybe there already are, but from what you just described, will there be monuments if they're telling a fuller story that will say that he was the commander-in-chief of the Continental Army in the American Revolution, was the first president of the United States, and was a slave owner? Would that be part of a monument?
I mean, I can't speak to, you know, what a specific monument might look like, but I will say that, you know, a lot of folks are telling those stories already. I mean, that's reality. And I think that a lot of the work that Monument Lab does and our collaborators do is about, again, illuminating the truth of our history.
Dr. Farber, you know, and there's so many examples we can give, and I'm not going to go into a lot of them, but here in central Pennsylvania, the Gettysburg Battlefield is obviously located in our listening area. We've talked about, you know, there have been people who say that the monuments to Confederate generals or the Confederacy don't belong in public spaces. They belong in a museum. Or there have been some people suggested not even on the Gettysburg battlefield should there be monuments to Confederates. How is that determined, and what's the school of thought? What's the trend nowadays toward that?
You know, I mean, this is really important. This is, you know, of course, a issue that is taking a spotlight across the country, but it's hyper local as well. And you know, really for generations, where we've seen inequalities, monuments have really strengthened them and spotlighted them. And just to give a sense about this idea of the Lost Cause Confederate monuments, you know, a study by the Smithsonian Magazine several years ago noted just limitedly $40 million dollars in taxpayer funds were going to ongoing maintenance of Confederate sites. And I've spent a lot of time in Germany doing research, writing a book on Americans and the Berlin Wall. And there's a heavy burden of history in Germany, but you won't find swastikas in public space. There is a real effort to have memorials that tell the truth, that have the scars on the surface. And I think something that we encountered in our audit, when we type into our study set, Civil War, we found nearly 6,000 entries across the country. 1% of records even mention slavery. The Civil War was fought undeniably about slavery. And those records don't even tell us what they're saying. It's just the word slavery shows up. And so I think when we have a country and we have a monument landscape that has lifted up more Confederates than civil rights leaders in our top 50, it's a moment to take a step back and really think about not just history in public spaces, but the way that history lives as a vital source. And I think, you know, we have these questions of where are we going? And I think in order to move forward, a different relationship to our past that fosters healing, that opens up a fuller history, that we aim to have multiplicity. We're not scared of questions. We're not scared. Our deep love of our country, of our cities, of our sites of history is to open them up and illuminate them as well.
Dr. Paul Farber is co-founder of the Monument Lab and co-director of the audit. Naima Murphy Salcido is director of partnerships for the Monument Lab. You can read the report, the audit, on our website, WITF.org. We'll have a link to it. I want to thank both of you for being with us today. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a great day.